How you doing, Ace?
Anybody been on base?
Nobody.
Nobody?
This I ain't seen much of.
Huh. Me neither.
Chappie, I never have. What's the matter?
I don't know if I have anything left.
Chappie, you just throw whatever you got, whatever's left. The boys are all here for you. We'll back you up, we'll be there. 'Cause Billy, we don't stink right now. We're the best team in baseball right now, right this minute, 'cause of you. You're the reason. We're not gonna screw that up. We're gonna be awesome for you right now. Just throw. All right? Come on. Come on.
My next guest was a first-round pick, fourth overall in the 1988 draft. He was an all-star in 1990, probably deserved four or five more than that. He's the Orioles' all-time save leader. His career ranged from 1988 to 2001, 90-plus fastball and arguably the best curve I've ever seen. Rookie of the Year in 1989, first reliever to win that award. He's a member of the Baltimore Orioles Hall of Fame. Please welcome Greg Olson to the show. Greg, how you doing today, my friend?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. So there's so much in that, what I just read. I mean, so you're born and you grow up in Nebraska, or is it? Or you, do you just grow up in Nebraska and you were born somewhere else? You spend most of your early life in Nebraska?
Yes, I was born in Scribner, Nebraska, and went to high school in Omaha.
Yeah, and one of the great things that's well known is how the success that you had as a pitcher playing for your father in high school. Does that strengthen the bond you have with your dad? In other words, so he's a coach, obviously. He's your father. You see him when you get home. Is it more difficult to have that? Because we're talking, you know, some pretty competitive baseball at this point. What is the rapport like with dad, Greg, at this point?
Oh, you know, it's great now. While we were going through high school, it was a little difficult.
Yeah.
You know, he was my coach, and there was expectations of, you know, how to act, and it was just, you know, just difficult to live up to the expectations of, you know, how I was supposed to act all the time and on the field, off the field, and it was, you know, it was a good learning lesson. It was just, didn't make for easy relationship.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear. I mean, you're the best athlete on the team at this point, or the best baseball player on the team at this point, and athlete. You know, and there's pressure there. There's pressure probably from, you know, teammates who you know, maybe, you know, there's always, you know, the dad's the coach thing, that sort of thing. But in your case, it's different because your ability probably squashed a lot of that. So I don't know, Greg. It seems like there's pressure in a lot of different places. There's your dad trying to kind of have you become this, you know, he's hard on you, you know, and that's kind of how dads are. Plus, he's your coach. And is there ever tension with, like, teammates that are also probably your friends at the time, too, having a dad as a coach?
You know, it really wasn't too bad. You know, we were a good team, and what, you know, my father had a track record of you know, getting it done at the high school level, and so, you know, whatever issues the teammates had, never really heard of them. You know, so it was a pretty good, you know, it was a pretty good situation. We had, everybody was on the same page and worked hard, and you know, if there were any problems, I didn't hear about them.
And then you make your way to Auburn. You know, it's one of the best schools on the planet in all, you know, any sport. I mean, the SEC is second to none, basically. You play for a guy named Hal Baird. Talk to me about Hal Baird, Greg.
Oh, Hal Baird was a great baseball guy, smart pitching coach, very, very calm demeanor. So, you know, he got up to AAA as a pitcher for the Kansas City Royals. So he knew, you know, he knew what it takes. He knew what it took to get to the next level. And you know, at the time, Bo Jackson was there. Excuse me. Frank Thomas was a year behind me. So, you know, all these guys just love Hal.
Yeah. And I mean, and then it comes to coaching philosophy. What do you think works best, Greg? Or does it depend on the person? I mean, do players prefer a coach that, like, so I live in Massachusetts. Cora is doing a great job. I see him as a player's manager. But I guess in general, what works today? Is it the Yeller, the kind of Belichick kind of disciplinarian, or is it the guy that's maybe a little closer to being, you know, one of the guys? I mean, what's your philosophy on that? What works?
Well, that's a tough. It really is a tough call. You know, everybody's different. Everybody takes coaches or managers a little bit differently. You know, you don't see a whole lot of the Yellers and screamers anymore. It's because, you know, generation of kids that are coming up have been, oh, how do I put this politely? You know, they're not used to that. They're just, you know, I don't think they'll react to it well. Just my opinion. So you're going to see more guys that are going to be players, guys that are, you know, pat them on the butt and say great job and everything's all puppies and roses.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is what you're trying to say, but I'll say how I feel about this. I mean, I think that, you know, when you look at this generation, when it comes to a competitive level like you had in high school or even if they make it to college at that point competitively to play, you know, the everyone gets a trophy generation, I think, struggles once things get competitive, whether it's travel ball or whatever. When they're told that, you know, finally that, you know, you're not good enough or this is exactly how I see your ability, I think kids coming up struggle a little bit with that. Greg, am I off with that?
I don't know. It's I think everybody's, in, you know, everybody's different. You just see the generation coming through that, you know, has been, you know, the trophy generation. The parents have made everything as easy as possible. And I don't know. I don't know where it'll go from here. But right now you can see, you know, you definitely see the effects of travel ball on the major league game.
Yeah, I mean, did you get a chance, just to change the subject a little bit, did you get a chance to watch the College World Series, the Oregon State-Arkansas game?
I did, yeah.
So the closer comes in where I think it was game two, you know, it's best two out of three, and it's my fault that I forgot his name, but he's a stud closer for Arkansas. He's basically closed the door. He's thrown some pitches. Fly ball, a pop-up, I think it was first base side, maybe a little deeper, closer to right field. Arkansas has a chance to put it away to the game, would have been third out. They drop the ball. It opens the floodgates. I had flashbacks of the 86 World Series watching the ball go between Buckner's legs. As a closer, Greg, what is, I'm not going to have you put thoughts in or words in his mouth, but if you were in that position, how do you... What would you feel? And I think you know the play I'm talking about.
Yeah, you know, the second baseman just overran it.
Yeah.
Put his head down and started running hard and just overran the play. And it was, I don't know if he called it, but I don't think the right fielder never had a chance at it. And first baseman, you know, that was a really difficult play for him. You know what? That's one of those where you have to reset. You know, you have a chance to win the game. And I would like to see somebody come out, you know, pitching coach or the catcher, just to go, hey, you know, we're still one pitch away. Let's just focus on making that pitch, let that one go, you know, bad break, and just, you know, find a way for somebody to go out there and kind of just reset his mind a little bit. Because it is deflating.
Yes.
And you see it, and the next guy gets a hit, and then you just knew they weren't going to win the next night.
Right. Oh, for sure. Yep. Yep. You know, and you're so right. I never even thought about that. You know, everyone's reeling. I mean, I'm sure players are like, we could have just won the, you know, put it away. But you're right. Somebody should have come out and just said, wait a second, let's just pump the brakes here. Let's, like you said, we're one out away. Let's compose ourselves. It's too bad because once that happened and nobody comes out, you know that Arkansas can, I mean, it's just all downhill after that. I mean, you're right. It was no gimme play for sure, but I don't know. That's where coaching, I think, or and I'm not putting it on the coach, but something should happen there where the players kind of had that, you know, that brought upon them where, you know, let's take an easy deep breath. I mean, that's really well said, Greg.
Well, you know, you just until you get in the middle of all that and you see, you know, the mood swings that happen, you know, you don't really recognize it, or you don't know what, you know, what's going on in the kid's mind. And I've been in that spot, and I kind of was going, you know, this next kid's going to get a hit, and all hell's going to fall apart. That's what happened.
Yeah, well said. You know, I went through your career at the beginning. You've done some marvelous things. You do radio now for the Orioles, correct?
Yes, I'm actually in Toronto right now, getting ready to get some lunch and then go over to the ballpark.
Oh, great. So, you know, I wanted to ask you about that. So I did go over your career, but I did go over one thing. You know, I felt like, and I'm not trying to, you know, be, you know, gotcha question or anything like that, but I do feel like in August of 93, and then they end up signing Lee Smith, I almost feel like they, I don't want to say give up on you, but I thought, I've seen it a lot, and we see it, you know, in New England sports. There's an athlete we had for the Celtics, Isaiah Thomas. I felt like he kind of went through the same thing you did. I don't want to say given up, but am I on the right road with that? Did you feel betrayed in any way, Greg, when you got hurt?
Well, you know what? They made a business decision. And at the time, they didn't know if I'd come back. I had a torn elbow ligament. And you know, for me at that point, I would have had to, for them to bring me back, I would have had to take a 20% pay cut knowing that the elbow's torn. And that was still going to be a lot of money. At the point, you know, I was making, I don't remember what I was making, but it was pretty good money. So the Orioles were, you know, making a business decision, and that's what Celtics did with Isaiah Thomas. Mm. You know, you come to a point in your life and your baseball career where you feel like I need to be loyal, but there's no loyalty on any side anymore in professional sports. So nothing surprises me. The Isaiah trade didn't surprise me, you know, and it's turned out to be a great trade. But there is no loyalty from the front office, and you know, they expect the loyalty from the players. Well, it doesn't work out that way anymore.
Yeah, to me, it's just personally heartbreaking. I'll use Isaiah because we're talking about him. He busted his ass. He kind of, you know, he gave them everything that year. His hip, you know, he played. And at the end of the day, he had nothing to show for it. And I don't know, you're right. There's no loyalty. But in my opinion, in any sport, I'm always on the player's side. Like, if they can get the money, fine. You know, I'm for them. If I have to choose between ownership and players, I'm always going player 100% of the time.
Well, yeah, but, you know, everybody's going to learn the lesson that there's no loyalty. And, you know, that was my lesson. It was, you know, the Orioles didn't bring me back after I got hurt. And, the point was that I should have taken better care of myself because, you know, they're not, you know, no teams are going to take care of you.
Mm.
And that's the lesson for the day.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, the type of injury you had, let's say your pitches, like, say you were cutter dependent, or you were, I don't know, change up fastball, whatever. So Do you think it was the curveball, the pressure? I mean, is that more of an injury-prone type of pitch, especially your – I mean, yours was devastating. Do you think that contributed to type of pitches, or is it just, you know, this was going to happen no matter what you threw or how you threw it?
You know what? I had a pitching coach, and the organization wanted to get me a little bit quicker to home plate, so there was a bit of a mechanical change in after the 91 season, and so 92, the effect of the mechanics change was that my breaking ball changed. I was able to locate inside the strike zone a lot better, but my breaking ball became a throw and turn curveball, which is more like a slider that I could get to the front and create the downward spin. So it was a totally different curveball than what I grew up throwing.
Mm.
It was effective. It was effective, and it was very it was just very violent on my arm, and that's, you know, 100% of why I blew out.
Yeah, I mean, it's something to think about. And, you know, being a first round, you know, fourth overall pick, going to minor league pressure, do you ever feel like you put added pressure on yourself? Was there pressure there? Or, you know, because of your closer, your mentality might be a little bit different, where, you know, closers are, I think, the toughest, the good ones are, like you and so forth, are the toughest people on the field mentally. Was there pressure there, being such a high draft pick?
No, I never felt that. I just had the pressure to, you know, get to the big leagues, and that was my pressure, and, you know, to succeed at that level, and that was, you know, just the pressure that I was, you know, growing up, this is what I wanted to do, this is what I expected to do, and so the only pressure that, you know, I was feeling was put on by myself. So it was, you know, being a first round pick, yeah, great. They, you know, they have the expectations of me, but if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. You know, I don't look at first round picks and go, okay, he has to make it, and there's a lot of pressure on him.
Right. No, that's really well said. You know, and I want to ask you a few more questions here. So you have a 1998 comeback of the year. At the time, you set the Arizona record for saves. You know, that was, you couldn't have seen that coming, especially with the type of injury you had. I mean, or did you think, you know what, I'm going to come back and I'm going to do my thing?
I was chasing what I was before I got hurt. So I was spending, you know, every bullpen, every spring training was trying to get back to what I was before I got injured. So for me, a lot of it was a mentality that I just felt like I was a lot better in the ninth inning. I was, you know, just eighth inning, yeah, but then the further away I got from the end of the game, I don't know, the less stressful it was, I wasn't as good.
Mm.
And so I just, you know, was always, you know, hoping when I became a free agent at the end of the year, it was searching for a place where I might have a chance to close games. And then I felt like that might, bring me back to closer to what I was before I got injured.
Right.
And so the Diamondback, you know, I got a little bit of opportunity in Detroit and actually threw well. The numbers don't. You know, I had two games that blew the numbers out of proportion. But, you know, did the job and was saving games. I got traded to Houston, and then they had Billy Wagner. So Arizona was really my first shot at closing games again.
Right. Yeah, give you back that
goal. So, yeah, long story short, I always felt like if I got back into that spot, I could, you know, I could revisit my, you know, my success.
Right. No, that's where you're most comfortable. Absolutely. That makes perfect sense. So Curt Schilling is your roommate early on?
He was my roommate in 88.
Okay. Greg, why? I think I know why, because I think part of it has to do with his political beliefs. I think the other part is, We the media here in Boston, many of them are not pleasant people. So he's one of the best big game pitchers in history. He's a no brainer Hall of Famer. Am I right? Am I on that? I'm right with that, right? That's accurate?
I don't know. I mean, you know, there's baseball is such a numbers game. He doesn't have the wins. You know? He had seasons of where, yeah, he was a Hall of Fame pitcher, but, you know, it's the overall package, and I don't know if he's got the wins.
No, it's valid.
And then, you know, that's my only issue. It's not the World Series. It's not, you know, the 20 games and everything else is mostly there. It's just the lack of wins.
How about in the scenario of guys like, you know, there's Clemens or Bonds or whomever, do you think the sports writers will ever come to a point where they ignore what's being said, or they, you know, look the other way, or do you think these guys are just have no shot ever of getting in?
Well, you know what, I mean, for the past couple of years, my indicator has been Mark McGwire. Mm. And now it just seems like they've completely gotten away from him. I don't even remember, you know what the last vote was for him. But it seems like Bonds is creeping up a little bit. Clemens is creeping up a little bit. McGwire is going the opposite direction. And so I don't really know anymore. Mm. I don't. I think they set the baseline with Shoeless Joe Jackson and Pete Rose that, you know, it's just they're not going to get in. But you don't know. I don't. It's one of those situations where I don't really think I have an answer.
Mm. Should Pete Rose be in?
I was such a fan of Pete Rose.
Me too.
You know what?
Me too.
The fact that he was hypothetically betting on the team that he was managing. I have a hard time with that one.
Yeah.
You know, because there is certain knowledge that everybody in the clubhouse has for, you know, that game of, you know, how it looks one way or the other. You know, if you're throwing a first year kid out against the 92 Blue Jays, you know, you're probably going to lose.
Right.
The Blue Jays are probably going to win. And there's just some things that you just know. So I have a hard time with, you know, with that issue on Pete. And that's, you know, probably going to keep him out for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Shoeless Joe Jackson, I got no idea why he's not in there.
Yeah.
But
I completely agree on both of your takes. Completely agree. So I wanted to ask you, should we get away from the sports writers voting and make it just a... I think the only people that should be voting on the Hall of Fame are people with Major League Baseball experience. Like, I'm not going to name names of a media here in Boston, right? But some of those guys vote, have no business voting. I think your vote, because you're a player, a successful player, and you don't have to have the success that you did, but I think players should be the only ones, or managers, voting on who gets in and who doesn't, because I believe they're the best sources, the most accurate sources. Am I dreaming, Greg, or is that a good solution?
Well, I don't think it's a bad solution. I mean, I can't tell you how insulting it is to have somebody say that, you know, Randy Johnson's time to come in, or you know, Biggio. All these guys that should have been first round, you know, first ballot.
Mm.
And somebody doesn't vote for him, so, you know, I don't know where we were at last year, at 90-some percent. And you're just like, it's a no-brainer. Why isn't this guy in? And one of the voters says, well, I don't want anybody to ever have 100%, so I'm not voting for him. Like, you're an idiot. You should lose your vote.
Yes, I agree. And then Greg, you always have that one guy that votes for somebody that's completely, like, you know, that you never expected, and that vote could have gone to somebody that really needed it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and then somebody votes for somebody just because they said they would.
Right.
And, I think, you know what, if you don't turn in a vote, you don't, you know, you make a stupid vote, I think you're out. And let's just start weeding out some of the voting. Because, yeah, definitely doesn't, gets annoying year to year.
Yeah. I mean, You know, there's a couple more questions I have for you. You've been so kind. Thank you. I'm taking you away from your lunch, so I appreciate this. So, you know, I'm a positive person. You're a closer. Have you ever had a chance to talk to Eckersley, whether it was, you know, in the past or recently? And what are your thoughts on Eckersley?
You know what? I was in camp with the Cardinals in '96 when he was there with La Russa. And yeah, we talked. It was, you know, it was, I liked him. It's just kind of funny to know what I know about being in the ninth inning and all the things that go through your mind, you know, during the game, you know, during the eighth inning, when you're walking out to the mound, knowing all the thoughts I had. I'd always just try to find out what other guys were thinking. And Dennis was, you know, a good guy, and we talked, and I don't have a problem with him. Apparently he's a little hit or miss in the Boston area.
See,
with some of the things that happened, but
yeah, I love him, and I think most people here love him. I'm going to tell you who I don't love, Greg. I'm not a big fan of David Price and Pedroia because it was an incident on a plane. And the reason I asked about Eckersley was because you're a closer, but two, there was an incident last year where Eckersley was, you know, when you listen to him call a game on Nesson, he is very honest. He's like, well, what are you thinking there? Why are you locating the pitch there? What are you thinking throwing a fastball down the middle on a 1-2 pitch? You know, he's very honest. And Price approached him and, and basically like showed up a Hall of Famer, and Pedroia is in the back of the plane like clapping. Like, where's the respect there? I mean, I don't mean to get negative. I'm just very passionate about that. I'm passionate about respect, and I think Eckersley deserves it probably more than anybody on that plane. I don't know. I mean, is it one of those things that you just have to be there? Or, I mean, you know the incident that I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what Eckersley said. And then what Price supposedly did or said on the plane. You know what? There is a little bit of you get offended when one of your guys that is doing the radio or the TV is being negative towards you as a player, knowing that he played. So it's not gonna say it's easy to get offended, but I've seen it. I understand it. So, you know, when I'm sitting there trying to call games, I'm trying to say it like it is, but I'm also trying to, you know, let everybody know, hey, the game's really hard.
Right.
And sometimes there are mistakes. And, you know what, until I get, you know, I don't question thought processes too much, you know, because who knows what they're trying to do.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's not like, it's not a clear cut game like golf. You know exactly what I'm trying to do on the golf course. I'm trying to hit the ball in the fairway. I'm trying, you know, and you know exactly where you're going. Baseball, pitching, hitting, you got no earthly idea what, you know, what thought processes are going on and what he's trying to do. So I try to stay away from it. I don't know Pedroia. I don't know David Price. There's probably better ways to handle, you know, if you don't like what somebody's saying about you, there's adult ways to handle it. I think what Eckersley did in his career definitely earns the respect of, hey man, you know, I heard you said this about this, what'd you see, why, you know?
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. Adults.
Yes, absolutely, Greg. That's just the human decent way of dealing with things. Never mind that this guy is one of the best closers of all time. But regardless, one of the things I wanted to ask you was about hitting charts, right? Because I've always wondered. I've heard you talk a little bit in the past. So, like, say you had a hitting chart on Tony Gwynn or Will Clark, right? Do the good hitters make you change that chart on a yearly basis? So if you said, I mean, Tony Gwynn's probably a bad example because he was a phenomenal hitter. But let's just say, you know, a hitter, right? You know, you pitch him this way, you pitch him that way, and then next year comes in and this hitter has adjusted where he might not bite for that, you know, curve on a 1-2 pitch. He might, He might have a different approach. He might have found a better way to deal with. Do you find that the really good hitters change that hitting chart, or do they remain consistent throughout a hitting throughout a hitter's career?
That's a tough one. You know, the good hitters, you don't have a real good place to go. You can, you know, one time go here, another time you can go here. You don't have a place to go to get them out. You know, Ken Griffey Jr., Tony Gwynn. Let's see, who else? Paul Molitor, Robin Yount, Wade Boggs. You could get them out once, but it was just because, you know, sequence or first time of seeing you or something, and you got them out.
Right.
You couldn't stay there. You couldn't throw Barry Bonds' fastball down and away over and over and over again because he hit it out the left.
Right.
You know, so you're constantly, you know who you're facing, and you're constantly adjusting. You're not assuming that you're going to get them out with the same pitch.
Right, right, right.
So now the guys that are hitting 250, not Hall of Famers, are guys that have places that you can go year in and year out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah, right.
So that's, you know, the question was kind of rigged because, yeah, Tony Gwynn, you know, I could get Tony out with change-ups, but if I kept trying to do it, it probably wouldn't work.
Right.
You know, I didn't face Tony a whole lot, but I had a little bit of success early on with change-ups. And then later on, I started mixing, you know, my fastball up a little bit in and out and breaking balls down, and it was never the same thing. Griffey was the same way. It's never the same way twice.
Right.
No,
so let's forget it's an all-star. So I definitely wasn't trying to hook you with that, but like, say, have you ever seen maybe an average player, maybe a non-Hall of Famer, adjust their approach? In other words, wow, this guy last year would have bitten on a, you know, I don't know, inside, whatever, you know, but now he's made some adjustments. Do you find that is that a norm? Or do you find that it's kind of a year in, year out, the majority of hitters are who they are? They're good players, but what you see is what you get. And I just wonder if there's a lot of adjustments on the hitter's part, which may confuse a pitcher, I guess, each year. I don't know how that would work.
That's a tough question. Generally, guys, you're constantly adjusting.
Right.
The pitcher to the hitter and vice versa. There's constant adjustments. So I'm constantly, unless there's one place for me to go that you cannot hit at all, then, you know, there's a game going back and forth. And at some point, you got to stop me from that one point that I can get you out.
Right.
And if you don't, then, you know, it's not... I don't know if it's an adjustment so much as just like a weak spot.
Right.
And guys get a little bit better, but, you know, for the most part, it was year in, year out, same thing. I just got to make the pitch.
Right. No, that's well said. And you're right. The one thing I didn't think about was, yeah, you guys have to make adjustments too. And, you know, I guess that's a question you've just answered. You know, you might say, you know, this certain hitter that you're facing, you know, he's 5-for-10 on that 2-2 curveball, right? So you might go with a fastball away, and then all of a sudden, you know, he's not expecting that because the chart on you says, well, you know, 2-2 curveball. So, yeah, pitchers make those same adjustments, Greg. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm constantly adjusting. And, you know, the age-old question for pitchers is, you know, when do you adjust? When do you make up? A different approach on a certain hitter, and, you know, when he's 0-for-4, 0-for-5, do I start switching stuff up to, you know, preempt his switch? And it's kind of a stupid question because it's like, you know what, maybe he's never going to make the adjustment.
Right.
And you're always going to be able to get him out. So, you know, there was guys that I got out with the same pitch over and over and over again. And it's like, you know what, I'm not changing until you, you know, show me that you can hit it. It goes back and forth, and you know, trying to think of a good Boston guy that comes to mind, and just, you know, obviously Wade Boggs didn't work that way.
Right.
You had to mix up Boggs' the pace. You had to throw up and in on him to make him uncomfortable. You know, he didn't chase the breaking ball in the dirt, so you had to get him out in the strike zone, which is, you know, a big battle.
Yeah, that's a good name to bring up. You know, Greg, I don't understand. There's when kids, you know, I coached, you know, varsity softball for 20, 25 years. Obviously, it's not professional baseball, but there's this fascination with pulling the ball, like pulling it. Boggs just sprayed it wherever it went, like one of the best opposite field hitters in history. I mean, do you notice that there's a fascination with pulling a ball versus like a good hitter where just go with it? Like, I mean, is it just more of a younger thing, or do you find that there seems to be a fascination with pulling a baseball?
Well, I think most people get, you know, assume that they're going to have more power pulling the ball, which is probably true.
Right.
And in today's day and age of, you know, everything's about the power, then, you know, you're going to see more guys doing it. If there was more guys like Boggs, it would go the other way with fastballs away. We wouldn't be seeing the shift and all the other stuff that has come in. So, yeah, no, I don't understand it either. You would assume that, you know, staying back, the guys that gave me the most problems were the guys that were willing to go the other way and, you know, hit the fastball the other way.
Yeah, and you did a little bit of scouting. How did you like that?
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. Got to just, you know, go watch Major League Baseball games and try to tell the Padres how to beat the Cardinals or whoever they were playing.
Yeah, and when you do the scouting like that, you know, I was watching a movie, Trouble with the Curve. How do you know what to see? So if you're scouting like a, I don't know, say if you were scouting a high school kid or maybe a minor league player, you know, how much of it is talent? How much of it is the kid's makeup mentally? Like, how do scouts look at that? You know, I never understood that. Like, how can they, I mean, obviously if there was a formula, there would be no misses. But, you know, as a scout, what did you look for? What did you see? How did you go about your job?
Well, I was strictly a major league scout, so I was the advanced scout for the Padres.
Mm.
I went and told the Padres how to, you know, how I saw getting guys out, or how so and so was pitching, or I would try to steal signs from the opposing teams. But you know, the question you're asking is, most of it's probably based on talent, but there is some on the demeanor, the attitude, the way he carries himself. You know, what percentage of that, I don't know, but.
Yeah, and I mentioned Trouble with the Curve. Is there a baseball movie that gets to you every time, Greg?
You know, I like For the Love of the Game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the best.
I think that's pretty realistic for the most part. Yeah, about Major League Baseball life.
Yeah, underrated movie too. I completely agree, and I know that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I didn't. Go ahead.
Okay, so you know, I know you called Little League games for ESPN. Am I right with that?
Yeah.
Do you think some of these kids, Greg, the younger kids, are trying too hard to be like major leaguers instead of kind of being like themselves? And I know that sounds so generic and so elementary, but when you watch an 11-year-old with a monstrous bat flip or taking, you know, 3.5 minutes to go around the bases after a home run, I don't know. I'm okay with kids doing the sportsmanship thing, trying to be like professionals, because there's a lot to love about the game. There's a lot to love about baseball and these athletes. But there's also some stuff that you probably don't want these kids doing. Did you see some of that when you did this? Do you ever almost want to pull a kid aside and say, wait a second, you know, maybe this isn't the best way to handle yourself?
Oh, I didn't, you know, that wasn't my spot to do that. You know, those coaches have been with the kids, parents, you know, everybody was happy to be there. I wasn't about to.
I don't mean like literally go up to them and say it, but is there a part of you that says, you know, in your own mind where you're like, geez, I wish somebody would talk to that kid, or I wish, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. I see a lot of that on TV when I watch the Little League World Series. There's so much beauty in the Little League World Series, but there's also like, okay, maybe this isn't so adorable.
Well, yeah, I don't like some aspects of the, you know, kids picking up from the major leaguers, like you said, the bat flip or the long trot around. But you know, at some point, somebody's going to take care of it, and hopefully, the coach does. But you know, if it gets to the point where he runs into me when I'm a kid, and then I'm just going to hit him, and then have somebody explain to him why he got hit, and then he can figure it out from there if he wants to keep doing it.
Right.
And that's kind of what happens in the big leagues. You just don't see it very often, and it's not talked about, but it's just, hey, you know what? Yeah, you want to take 5 minutes and run around the bases, that's fine. So next time I see you, you're going to get some bad ribs.
So, I mean, you're a closer. Obviously, you guys are the toughest people mentally on the field, in my opinion. Who do you love watching close? Who really impresses you? Like, we have a great closer in Boston. Who impresses you when you watch? And you see a lot of games because of the nature of your job. Who's a guy that when you watch, you're like, Jesus, this kid has got it. This kid is just unhittable.
You know what? I mean, I love Kimbrel's stuff. I do like to watch him. Just seems like some of these guys make it look so easy now that I start to question myself, going, man, these guys are making it look way too easy. And I don't know if it's just the hitters aren't, you know, backing down and trying to get something in play and make something happen. But, you know, then you see the All-Star game and see how hard it is to finish a game.
Yeah, but hey, Greg, none of them had their own pitch named after. I mean, you had your own name for your curveball. I mean, who could say that?
Yeah.
Well, so I have one or two final questions for you. One of my last things I wanted to ask you is you've had so many achievements. I mentioned them early on. There's some I didn't mention. You know, the no-hitter in Oakland. You met a few presidents. You know, you have a winning record for a reliever or a closer, which is unbelievable because most do not. 41 scoreless innings. You should have been on more All-Star teams. Is there a moment that stands out that you're most proud of, or one that just means a lot to you?
I mean, the All-Star game was, you know, the pinnacle of where I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. And yeah, I probably should have made about two or three more, but I was trying to explain that to my 15-year-old son. He's like, well, okay, but why? And I was like, well, we had a 25-man roster, so we had 9 pitchers. You know, and he's just kind of looking at me. He's like, what's the roster now? I was like, it's 35. They've taken everybody.
Right.
And, you know, that would have gotten me on about 3 more probably, but the All-Star game was probably my highlight.
Yeah, I mean, if we fast forwarded to now, oh my God, you would have been easily in 4 All-Star games, and you deserved it. But you know what? I don't believe being an All-Star, I mean, it's great that you made it, but your career was still going to be a fantastic career regardless, Greg. I don't think, you know what I'm saying, like not making 2 or 3 hurts you. I mean, it stinks because it's kind of one person's opinion, which kind of is like, and you definitely should have been on those teams, but whatever. I mean, it doesn't hurt your career at all. So, anything you wanted to promote, Greg? Anything you wanted to get out there? Or I wanted to ask you that.
No, I'm good. Okay. I appreciate the, you know, enjoy talking to you, and I'm good. I don't have anything I'm working on or trying to peddle. So
yeah, you're a real good guy, and I really appreciate you giving me time. You had to go for lunch. I did have one more quick question. What went wrong with the Orioles this year? Because I look at this team at the beginning of the year, and my goodness, I thought it was stacked. Great manager, you know, you got some hitters there in the infield. What happened?
Well, if you can figure that one out, then you will. I have no earthly idea. Like I said, I've been doing the radio for them, and I just don't. I don't think anybody knows what happened. You know, you got Manny Machado, Adam Jones, you got guys that can swing it, and just by the time I got here and started my first games at the end of April, you know, I mean, there's three guys in the lineup that are hitting 190.
Right.
And then the pitching staff struggles a little bit, and they're just unable to score runs. I don't know what it is. It's just that's all it is. They're unable to score runs on a consistent basis. What am I doing?
Were you happy with the haul they got for Machado?
You know what? We won't know about how good that trade was for 4 or 5 years.
No, you're right.
So everybody's saying, "Oh, the Dodgers won that trade." I'm like, "How do you know?" That's just
yeah.
These trades take 4 to 5 years for these kids to pan out or not.
Yeah, you can't compare an all-star to prospects. That's ridiculous. I thought it was a great trade because Machado's going to leave at the end of the year anyway. Zach Britton's probably on his way out as well, right? I mean, if you had to guess.
I would guess that it's probably going to be a fire sale right now. If you didn't trade Manny Machado, there's no reason to keep anybody else.
Right. Well, well said, and I will not keep you from your lunch anymore. Greg, thank you so much for coming on. You're really a good dude and, phenomenal career, and, I can't thank you enough. I'm really blessed that you came on today.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, you have a good day. I'll catch up with you again soon.
Thanks, Greg.